I know you don't want to hear this right now, but one day, when you lighten the hip-hop world on fire, it'll be because you have a unique perspective. And when you collecting all your Source Awards, you'll thank me.
Source Awards? Is that as far as I get in your dreams?
All right, you're right.
Can I get a Grammy or something?
Nobel Prize, how about that? Thank me in that speech.
Hey friends, welcome back to Represent. I'm Aisha Harris, your host, as always. And I hope everyone is enjoying the last bit of summer before we slide on into the season of boots and pumpkin-spiced everything. Thankfully, my academic days are far behind me, but for lots of youngins, it's just about back to school time. And what better way to honor the occasion on this show than to talk about the evergreen genre of coming-of-age stories? Today, we're going to home in on such stories that are presented from the perspective of people of color. That clip you just heard at the top of the show is from Morris from America, a new film starring Craig Robinson and Marquise Christmas about a black father and his teenage son who moved to the unfamiliar, all-white city of Heidelberg, Germany. But first, we're going to chat about the new Netflix show, The Get Down, the dazzling, dizzying, Baz Luhrmann-produced musical drama which follows a group of black and brown teens growing up in 1977, the Bronx, amidst the backdrop of the peak of disco and the birth of hip-hop. And appropriately enough, my former grad school classmate and friend, Tiffany Vasquez, who is now the Saturday afternoon host for Turner Classic Movies, joins me today. Hello.
Hello.
I'm so glad you're on the show.
I'm so happy to be here. Oh my gosh. So happy.
I'm so glad you were not turned off by me and Antonia in the first episode, just like gushing about you.
Oh my God. Antonia's awesome. Thank you so much for that. It was, I was starting to cry on the train listening to it.
Oh no.
But yeah, I'm so excited to be here. This podcast is so, so, so good. And I just love it so much.
Oh, thank you. I mean, first, I don't know if you want to share a little bit about like what you do on Turner Classic Movies, because it's pretty freaking cool.
I introduce and give a little bit of an outro to every movie that plays every Saturday. And on the Eastern time, it's the afternoon. So it'll start at 12 noon. And usually the last movie airs around 6. So that's every single Saturday. And of course, West Coast time, it usually airs, starts at 9 a.m. And it's whatever's on TCM at the moment. And we're ending August now. And August, of course, is Summer Under the Stars on TCM, where 24 hours is dedicated to a star. And some I've been able to introduce a whole chunk of Humphrey Bogart movies, which is just crazy that I was able to do that.
Yeah.
That in my first shoot, I did Casablanca, which is like... It's surreal to be introducing that on Turner Classic Movies.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
That's part of what I do. And of course, I'm around for other TCM-related events. Just, I don't know, it's been pretty fantastic.
Yeah, that sounds so exciting. And you are the first female host of TCM, right?
Sure, yes. The first regular female.
Regular female host. And the first Latina.
Yeah.
Yay! I know how big of a film nerd you are. You and I went to NYU for cinema studies together.
We sure did.
Yeah, I'm so proud. So
thank you.
Anyway, now that we've praised each other to the high heavens, let's jump into The Get Down, which Tiffany, you texted me like a week ago, and you said, please tell me we're going to talk about The Get Down.
Yes, I did. Because, okay, I was like, well, maybe she's thinking we'll talk about it, but maybe she's not. So I need to make sure.
No, I'm glad you did. Because I actually, to be honest, I hadn't even thought that far. Mm-hmm. And so when you mentioned it, I was like, that's perfect.
Yeah. Because it's obviously, if anyone knows me, it's a story I'm kind of protective of, and it hits very close to home. I am Puerto Rican. I live in the Bronx. Most of my family is from the Bronx. And my mother was 12 in 1977. My mother's generation, all that whole generation of my family grew up with hip hop in the Bronx. And it's something that I know the story from hearsay. I know the story from all the stories people told me. Mm-hmm. And these are firsthand accounts. And it was a little bit unnerving for me to learn that Baz Luhrmann was handling it.
Yeah. So, I mean, let's talk a little bit about, just explain the premise a little bit for people who might not be familiar.
Yeah.
It's Netflix's new
new
I guess it's a two-part musical. They dropped the first six episodes a couple weeks ago, mm-hmm. and they're going to drop the final six in next year.
Yeah, I think so.
And so it centers around a bunch of black and brown kids mm-hmm. growing up in the Bronx yes. in 1977. Mm-hmm. And the lead kids in this musical
right.
are Zeke, played mm-hmm. by Justice Smith.
Yep.
And you have, can you pronounce it, Harrison F. Guardiola?
Yeah, that seems about right. Guardiola. I've never heard her in an interview or anything. I've never heard anyone say her name.
Yeah.
So I've just been reading her name.
Well, Guardiola, she plays Mylene Cruz. Yeah. And they're sort of on again, off again, crush, lover,
yeah.
friends. mm-hmm. And Zeke, he's actually half black and half Puerto Rican,
yes.
and he's living with his aunt after both of his parents have died.
Correct.
And he loves to rhyme and write poetry,
right.
and his teacher is telling him, you know, you need to do this scholarship mm-hmm. or this internship, but he also, like, loves music.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's that. There's a lot going on. It's very hard
so
to
much.
Be concise when
there's
talking about
a
this.
A lot going on.
Because you also have Mylene also loves music, but
yes.
she's more of a, she wants to be a disco queen. She
yeah.
wants to be a sort of Donna Summer type.
Right. Because at this time, hip hop didn't exist yet. So
right.
still, Zeke is like figuring out what this is.
Exactly.
And Mylene doesn't know what that is either. And it seems a little too not refined enough for her. So she wants to sing disco. She wants to be Donna Summer.
Yeah. And so she also has an uncle
mm-hmm.
played so flamboyantly by Jimmy Smits,
mm-hmm.
who is named Francisco Cruz.
Yeah.
And he's sort of the, I don't know what you'd call him, he's like a community organizer.
Yeah.
He is connected both to the Puerto Rican population in the Bronx, but
right.
also to the government.
Yes.
And he's trying to strike a deal with Koch.
Yeah.
There's a funny moment in, I think, the fourth episode where they go back and forth about cock.
It's so funny.
Yeah, it's like, but he's trying to get affordable housing
yeah.
for the people in the Bronx, and
right.
he's trying to strike a deal with Koch to
mm-hmm.
to give him help him get the vote while Koch is trying to become the mayor.
Right.
So there's all of that.
Yes. And that's on top of the state of New York at the time, the state of the Bronx at the time, right? It was in literal shambles. You had buildings in rubble. You had landlords either burning down buildings themselves or paying people to burn down their buildings because the insurance payoff was way more worth it than actually sticking around. Crime was ridiculous. You've had everything from redlining to, you know, all these socioeconomic things happening at the time where it just seemed like a very desperate situation. And then you have things which one episode, of course, covers, like the blackout.
Mm-hmm.
And these were times in New York that are historic. You know, sayings the Bronx is burning, you know, that's going to live on for a very long time. And these are effects that we're still living with in the Bronx. Still, how many people do you know live in the Bronx or from the Bronx in your whole New York life so far?
You.
Yeah.
You. And my producer, Marilyn, raised her hand as well.
Yeah.
But you live in Brooklyn now, Marilyn.
But I was raised in the Bronx.
Right.
Yes, yes. Well, to be fair, well, my aunt and uncle lived in the Bronx when I was in my early, early childhood, but they haven't lived there for years. So
yeah.
I've probably been to the Bronx since then three or four times.
Right. It's still this stigma from then. No matter where I've worked, no matter where I've interned, there are people like, oh, that's cool. You live in the Bronx. That's nice. And then chances are maybe they've been to Yankee Stadium. Maybe they'll take a day to go to Bronx Zoo or Botanical Gardens.
Mm. Only on Wednesdays.
Right. Only on Wednesday when it's free.
See, I didn't even know that.
There's still this thing about the Bronx that is just so it's just so separated. Of course, I can't say that without saying Staten Island probably has it the worst.
I was going to say, at least you're not Staten Island.
Right.
You don't have to take a ferry to get there. But yeah, no, I totally admit the Bronx, being in Brooklyn, it's even difficult for me to go to Harlem, much
yeah.
less the Bronx. So I totally get that. I think the Get Down, despite being, the first episode at least is directed by Baz Luhrmann, and then
yeah.
he basically executive produced the mm-hmm. entire thing.
Right.
The show does very much try to capture the Bronx as burning.
Yes.
It's very, to some varying degrees, mm-hmm. I think the first episode, can we talk about the first episode?
Yeah, my least favorite episode.
It made me actually, I almost was, if I hadn't had to, you know, write about it or work, like for work, mm-hmm. I was just thinking to myself, this is a mess.
Yeah.
And I know it's Baz Luhrmann and everyone uh-huh. says, what do you expect? Because, and I'm, right. I know, but this felt like chaos beyond even Baz Luhrmann's wildest dreams.
Mm-hmm.
Just the way their scenes felt truncated, the diet, like Jimmy Smits was all the way up to 120 in a way. He tones it down a bit afterwards.
Sure.
And Giancarlo Esposito, who I usually love as the, as, so he plays Pastor Cruz, who is Mylene's father.
Uh-huh.
And he, it's, you know, the typical story of Pastor is not happy that his daughter wants to sing disco or sing the devil's music.
Yeah, it's like a Pentecostal pastor, super stereotypical Bronx Latino, like Spanish church, people going convulsing, speaking tongues in the church, flipping, doing all that type
was
of
that
stuff.
Real like realistic? Because you are religious. So was that realistic?
So
for
you? That's a little turned up compared to, I mean, my grandparents' church, it was a, they grew up in a church in East Harlem that was a Pentecostal church. It was a Spanish speaking. And it's like, this is just like a caricature of that. You know, of course, there were a lot of moments that were like, if that was on 10, their churches were maybe like 2 to 3 on that volume scale. But It made me a little sad because we know Giancarlo is amazing. We know that when he's turned down, he can be so much more effective.
He simmers so well.
Oh, my gosh. We know it.
Yeah.
And so now seeing him in this role was you know, a little bit of a letdown.
Yeah. Overall, the first episode and the fact that it's 90 minutes long is also, it just tries to pack too much into one up. It's basically a short direct to video movie.
Yeah, basically.
And it just seemed to try to strike. So you have that whole narrative. You mm-hmm. also have Shaolin Fantastic played by Shameik Moore.
Uh-huh.
He's from Dope.
Yep.
That's probably his biggest claim to fame at this point.
Yeah. Which is funny because when I finally saw him at the VMAs, I was like, oh, so that's what he looks like in 2016.
Oh, yeah.
Like not being in any sort of time period piece. Yeah. And even then, he looked like a 90s throwback.
Yeah, for sure. I think so Shaolin Fantastic, he is a upcoming b-boy. He is studying under Grandmaster Flash.
Yeah.
And Grandmaster Flash in real life is one of the producers on the show, mm-hmm. as are Nas.
Yeah.
And I think Kool Herc might have advised to some extent. That I guess even though Baz Luhrmann is directing and executive producing this, he at least had the wherewithal to actually reach out to people who have some connection to hip hop. So there's that.
Right.
After that soundtrack. So Shaolin Fantastic he's training under Grandmaster Flash, and he's hoping that Grandmaster Flash will teach him how to DJ.
Right.
And he does a lot of kung fu.
He does
stuff. He's inspired, and that's pretty realistic. To like, people were very into kung fu.
Bruce Lee was like a god to youth at that time, and so while at first it definitely rubbed me the wrong way, I was like, this is stupid. But
that's how I felt.
But then I really started to like it after a while. It started to feel more to me like, right, this is their way of being superheroes, mm-hmm. right? Like the power of hip hop, the power of DJing, the power of moving a crowd and getting a reaction from them and using all of these things amidst the fact that so many forces are against you,
mm-hmm.
That, yeah, you feel like a superhero. There is a sort of like power to it.
Yeah. What do you think overall? So the first episode is pretty not easy to watch.
Yeah.
And you may feel disheartened after watching it. But it does get better once the storylines sort of start to merge, mm-hmm. and also become like collapse. So there's not as many to follow, and things make more sense. And the episodes are shorter. They're only an hour after that. And I mean, at the center of this is really And what I think is really unique about this is the fact that this is a coming of age story, which mm-hmm. we've seen so many times, right. but it's from the perspective of Black and brown kids.
Yeah, yeah.
And also from a period, like a time period that I don't think, you know, there are tons of movies and documentaries that have been made about this time period, but
sure.
they're not, this feels unique and different to me.
Yeah, I agree. It's got a humanity to it. It's got emotions. It's got, you know, a lot of melodrama, but it takes an actual narrative from this instead of just presenting facts and just showing people starving or committing crimes or anything like that. You've got an Afro-Latino who is just trying to figure out life. And it's so that's why after watching a lot of episodes, I really started to love it. The parts that I liked, I loved. I, first of all, am really happy to finally see some credit, I guess, given to the Puerto Rican element of this foundation of hip hop, mm-hmm. because I think most times we don't really shed light on that. You've got people like Crazy Legs, who is definitely the most famous breakdancer in history and probably always will be, but still not really given the amount of praise in the creation of hip hop, along with maybe like Kool Herc or Grandmaster Flash, which of course they deserve, but there's room for, I think, everybody.
Right.
And there's so much Puerto Rican pride in this show
yeah.
that I was not expecting. I mean, we were definitely there and I'm happy to see it. I didn't think someone would actually pay attention to it and present it. So that really surprised me and it made me very, very happy to see. And the fact that it's so mixed. There are Afro-Latinos, you know, creating these things. We need that. We need to shed light on the fact that we're all together in this. There's a lot of separation. And mm-hmm. the fact that there is so much inclusion in this, not only between ethnicities and Bronx at the time, but then you've got the four elements of hip-hop being shed light on equally, I think. The honor to DJs, the honor to emceeing, also breakdancing, and graffiti artists. You've got Jaden Smith.
I have very mixed feelings on. Sometimes yeah. I think he's just adorable, and mm-hmm. also I love that he just does his own thing. And then yeah. sometimes I think that he needs to be reeled in a little bit.
Right. Yeah. I agree with that. Yeah. But I do love when he's just out there and himself. It's like, of course it'd be Jaden playing this guy.
And Jaden plays one of Zeke's friends, because Zeke has a bunch of mm-hmm. friends. There's like four or five of them.
Right.
And he's obsessed with graffiti art.
Yeah. And I will say, was it the end of the first episode? I think it was. When they finally get to the get down, the actual party.
That's the end of the first episode.
Yeah, that's the end of the first episode. And so the whole time I was actually kind of upset about how everything was treated so far.
Mm-hmm.
And then it gets there and then I felt it. I was like, okay, I'm on board. Because then it started to, the thing with the Baz Luhrmann effect is all the glitz, all the glamour, all the CGI, the things that I did not particularly like about Moulin Rouge, about The Great Gatsby, and probably about Romeo and Juliet is just I like Romeo and Juliet because I think it's just the nostalgia aspect of it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that just kind of stayed with me. But the things I did not like about Great Gatsby and Moulin Rouge are a little bit brought in to the Get Down. And I was just so sad that for such a story that's so real and gritty in a good way, I didn't need all the polish and all the fantastical elements.
Yeah, I feel especially the sort of, I mean, they try to do that effect. I notice in some of the episodes they have that rear projection screen, yeah. which I can sort of say rear,
I can't say
rear, rear, rear. And, you know, they're trying to make it look grainy mm-hmm. and gritty, but it looks polished and
yeah.
while they're doing it.
So yeah, and I understand they're trying to match what archival footage they actually do put in. So I get it if that's the method, but it's still, like, we can tell.
yeah. It's not.
Yeah. So, yeah. But then when it finally gets to the Get Down, it becomes, for me, like, magical. All the fantastical elements come alive, and it just shows it shows, I think, the proper amount of energy that it should show for the fact that you are walking into history being made.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is a hellhole for all intents and purposes in the Bronx. Yet the one art form that's prevailed for decades now and has become the most influential force worldwide that has taken people from nothing to everything is now being created. And you need that kind of energy. You need to see that kind of beauty. And I think everything came together at that moment. And there are a few moments other than that, where mostly at the Get Down and things like that, where I feel it again. And I'm super in love with those moments.
Yeah. I think also we have this story being told, and it's not like this could be a white kid. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not
right.
It's not possible.
Yeah.
Like, there, that's not the way it is. And I kind of want to branch out the conversation a bit, because I think that's a lot of times when you're talking about these sorts of films
mm-hmm.
that are coming of age stories. And so often we get the white guy.
Yeah.
it's a white kid.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's a white girl.
Mm-hmm.
Just looking at the Wikipedia page for coming of age story.
Oh my goodness. I'm so glad. Yeah. I Googled coming of age movies and I was like, dang, this sucks.
Yeah. every single on the Wikipedia page as of this moment, almost every single one that they list here of films that could be included in the genre of teen film / coming of age films.
Right.
All of them except for E2 Mama Tambien mm-hmm. and The Motorcycle Diaries.
Right.
It's about a white person.
Yeah.
And most of them are white boys.
Yeah. And you think of what are like the, for me, the first ones I thought of when I thought of coming of age movies, what is it? Stand By Me and Now and Then.
Yeah.
Like those are the two, I think.
Yeah.
And in recent years, of course, Boyhood. Mm-hmm. So, and I started, you were like, oh, what about some coming of age movies? And I started thinking about them. I was like, oh my God. It's not like I should be shocked.
but the thing is that there are a ton. It's just they don't get talked about.
Yeah.
I can think of, I mean, I made a list, but mm-hmm. I could think of that off the top of my head. You can look at Crooklyn.
Yes.
Spike Lee's Crooklyn, which is, it's one of his few movies that has a female protagonist.
Yes.
And she's, I think that's probably the best written female character mm-hmm. he's ever done. Coolie High
yeah.
is a coming of age story. Pariah, D. Reese's Pariah, which... Yeah. I rewatched some clips yesterday, and it's still that movie. I feel has also some very culturally specific things going on there.
Right, right.
And Kim Wayans is just as her mother.
Yes.
Yeah. I don't even. I don't even know what to say. If you haven't seen Pariah, so Pariah is about.
Pariah's great.
Yeah. Pariah is about a teenage girl named Alike. She's played by Adepero Oduye. And she's clearly experimenting, trying to figure out what she is in terms of her sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
She has her best friend is a gay woman, and she hangs out with her. And her mother, played by Kim Wayans, is not having that.
Not at all.
A religious household.
Yeah.
And it's just a really lovely story about her uncovering what that is
mm-hmm.
and what she wants. And there's a great scene where she asks her friend to buy her a dildo so that she can, you know, and it's for her to strap on and wear out, you know. And it's just funny because her friend buys her a white dildo. And she's like, you couldn't find a brown one or a black one. And just those little moments,
right?
I just appreciate that sort of, because there are other examples of the gay kid trying to figure out their sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we don't often see that from the perspective of people of color.
Yeah.
And that, to me, even if it, I don't want to heap all the praise on it only because of that, because it is a very well-written movie.
Yes.
And it's extremely well acted and directed.
Mm-hmm.
But that, to me, is kind of what stands out about that sort of storytelling.
Yeah. And one of my favorites in the last 2 to 3 years is Girlhood.
A movie I must admit I still have not seen yet.
Okay.
But I've heard so many good... Can you elaborate?
Yeah. You've got a young woman. She's coming of age, teenager, in right outside of Paris. I think it's La Défense, if I can remember correctly, because I did study abroad there and I recognize the building. And it's played by Khadija Touré. And she plays Vic. And she's joins this, becomes friends with a group of girls who, you know, they're kind of bad. You know, they act up, they fight, they do all that. But really, they're sweethearts at the end. They're friends, and they start to navigate teenagehood together. And there's this one scene that's just like that everyone talks about, where they just sing or lip sync, I don't remember which one, Rihanna's Diamonds together.
Oh, I've seen that scene.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
that's a powerful song.
And it's just like, they play the whole song, and it's just girls singing to each other that shine bright like a diamond. Like, you know, that's amazing. And when I saw that scene, I couldn't really remember the last time I'd seen anything like that, in just taking the time out. No cuts. Well, maybe there's some cuts, but nothing, like no interruptions, really.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing else to focus on other than just living in the moment and being young and having friends. And that's one movie that's definitely stayed with me for a long time, especially if thinking of coming of age, along with Raising Victor Vargas is one that...
Another movie I haven't seen. When did that come out? Was that...
2002.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it takes place all in LES, all in Lower East Side. Mm. You've got mostly Latino, people who have lived there for years. This is not a gentrified LES. This is people who have been there for decades and decades. And you've got Victor Asuk playing Victor. And Judy Marte, who is in The Get Down as Zeke's aunt.
Oh.
Because it's so good. And there's this one moment where, if I remember right, Victor's grandmother is... just bathing her grandkid and uses a can of Cafe Bustelo, like the coffee can, mm-hmm. to rinse the hair out, an empty can. And seeing things like that, like that's what representation is, right? Like it's seeing things that you're like, oh, my grandma does that. This is how I grew up. Things about this actually hit home to me. This is not a completely foreign thing. I don't have to try to relate to this character. I already do.
Yeah.
And that's why I love Raising Victor Vargas. It's such like a good indie New York coming of age movie.
Those are two movies I need to bump up on my have to watch list.
Yeah,
then.
Yeah. Which I'm sure is ridiculously long.
It's very long. Girlhood has been in my Netflix queue for, I mean, ever since it dropped.
Yeah.
And I just have not gotten around to it. Mm-hmm. But I'm gonna bump it up a little bit.
Yeah, definitely.
Before we go, let's get into our plus or deltas. What is your plus this week?
I was on the fence about whether this was contrived or not, but I was really surprised by the amount of representation in this week's VMAs, this year's VMAs.
Mm.
I felt like, first of all, I don't think there was a white host at all for the night.
No, I think they had DJ Khaled,
mm-hmm.
Nicole Byer,
right,
and Key and Peele.
Yeah.
And they might have had, oh, I think Jay Farrow was like popping in and out.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
And the main people honored that night were Rihanna, Beyonce with her mini concert.
Yes.
And I was, and Kanye, who, you know, those were the three big moments of the night, if I could guess three.
Yeah.
And it was incredibly, and of course, the three, if I could say the three people who won the VMAs, it's Rihanna, Beyonce, and Teyana Taylor.
Oh, damn it.
So I was actually really surprised that it was that way. And of course, MTV got a lot of backlash for not representing rock in any way.
Really?
A lot of people went at them.
I'm sorry. I know this is really terrible of me, because if they hadn't represented R&B, although I don't even know they represented R&B. R&B doesn't
well,
really exist.
What is R&B right now?
Yeah, but it doesn't really exist. But, you know, but rock...
Yeah, no, I'm with you on that, but you know, also I get it if it's music television and there's no, but I think it's also speaking to the state of rock right now too, right?
Yeah, I mean, there was a time when the VMAs were at least 60-75% rock.
Yeah. I was surprised though. I was like, well, that's interesting.
Yeah.
That happened.
Yeah, it was nice. And I also just love I'm not Caribbean, but I love the fact that Rihanna just repped that so hard.
That's the best Rihanna.
Yeah.
All we want is Bashment Rihanna. Yeah. That's all we want.
Yes. How many? She had like 400 black people
that's
on stage.
That's what
once.
I love. Bring them all.
I don't think I've ever Damn seen it. Them any yeah. black people on that on VMA stage.
Oh my God. Yeah. That's probably never happened, but yeah. I am here for it. Every moment of it. She was like, I'm bringing every person I know.
Yes.
And you will deal.
Yeah. And what would be your delta?
Still with the VMAs. I thought Kanye would do more with the 4 minutes that MTV gave him.
Yeah, that was diminishing returns.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's funny because MTV tells Kanye he can do whatever he wants for 4 whole minutes. And at first he mentions Chicago and I'm thinking, oh, he's going to bring a word right now. Mm-hmm. He's going to put everybody in their place and he's going to speak to it. And then he kind of didn't. He kind of went all over the place and started shouting out Ray J and Amber Rose and Taylor Swift. I'm like, these are the same people you've been talking about for a few years.
Yeah.
I would have loved for him to sober people up for a second and be like, this is crazy. And he's someone who talks very much about the fact that he has so much influence, that he is part of – he's super influential, one of the most influential people currently living on this planet.
Mm-hmm.
And he could have – created a conversation around it that I thought would have been incredibly useful and poignant and powerful. And he didn't really do that. So I was let down by that.
Yeah, that is a fair point. Kanye was, more than anything, I was bored.
Yeah.
I didn't care.
Right.
For my plus, mm-hmm. I'm going to have to go with the fact that Kerry Washington, it was just announced that she is developing
yes.
a female LAPD drama.
I read that last night and I was considering that for a plus.
Yeah. I mean, I don't really, it's early, so we don't really know much about it.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm just totally here for that.
Here for it too. Bronx girl. Kerry Washington.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I always think of her because the first time I ever saw her was in friggin' Save the Last Dance.
Yeah.
With that terrible accent.
Open up your pretty brown eyes and look the hell around.
What was it? When Julia Stiles is like, or she's like, take off that shirt. You look country.
It's country and you look country in it.
Oh, man. Yeah, I know him. He's my brother. Oh, Kerry Washington and Save the Last Dance.
Oh, my God.
But yes, I'm just really excited that she is. Women especially, but women of color mm-hmm. especially, who are not just content to be actresses and who are really putting their power, influence out there.
Right.
And for her to create a female LAPD cop drama, mm-hmm. which it also makes me think of, remember Dyke and Fats?
Yes, SNL? Of course.
That would be cool.
How could I forget?
That would be kind of awesome if that turned out to be what it was. It's probably not going to, but Dyke and Fats is the skit from SNL with Kate McKinnon and mm-hmm. Aidy Bryant as two female hard-nosed cops. The 70s-themed hard-nosed cops.
Yeah.
So I'm looking forward to seeing what that entails.
Same.
My delta is the way in which people have responded to this whole Birth of a Nation Nate Parker thing.
Mm.
It bothers me that, I mean, we can talk about what he did
yeah.
or didn't do.
Right.
I think the way he handled it was not a good look.
Yeah.
It was just disrespectful. And now he's owned up to it. And
yes.
he had that recent Ebony Peace
mm-hmm.
interview where he repeated the phrase toxic masculinity
yeah.
many, many times.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a step in the right direction. But what bothers me almost as much, if not more, are the people who are claiming that this is, you know, him, this is Hollywood trying to tear him
yeah,
down.
Yeah, yeah.
Which Fox Searchlight gave him $17 million to make that movie. I don't think they want to tear him down.
Yeah, I agree. It's been, it's the highest deal ever at Sundance in Sundance history.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
Yeah, they gave him, or not to make it, but to distribute it. And mm-hmm. so, yeah, to me, it just speaks to people, again, not wanting to believe women when things like this happen.
Right.
trying to use a scapegoat of quote unquote the man. And look, uh-huh. I am just as frustrated with the way Hollywood treats people of color.
Yeah.
As anyone else. This whole podcast is about that.
Yeah.
But we can't put blinders on and just walk through this tunnel and think everything is about that. And
totally.
I feel like the word intersectionality is used a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But in this instance, I have to, for lack of a better way of saying it, I have to side with the feminine part of me or the woman part of me, which believes this woman. And
correct.
And whatever happened, you know, we don't know what happened,
yeah.
But we also know that he did not handle it well after whatever happened.
Totally. We were around for this latter part, right?
Yes.
Like we saw what he could have done with the situation,
right.
How he could have treated everything, and
right.
It has not been treated with respect.
No respect. So that is my delta. I hope. It's going to be a long Oscar season. We're going to
yeah.
be talking about this a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I just, it saddens me that people are are not looking. And also just, I think I was listening to Code Switch did a very fascinating roundtable about this. And someone made the smart point on that roundtable that, you know, there are other Black people and people of color who are just as talented, who are also waiting for their turn. So
yeah.
It's not like if he gets knocked
yeah.
down, there's not going to be other people there.
Right.
So,
all our chips weren't on him.
Yeah.
Or shouldn't be.
No, that's not the case anymore. We're
yeah.
we are lucky that we live in a time now where things are getting better
yes.
and there are more options and there are more avenues. And
totally.
So that is my take, and that is my delta. I hate to end on that note.
Very solid delta though.
Thank
I'd
you.
Say.
Yeah. So with that said, thank you so much, Tiffany.
Thank you.
I'm so glad we got to talk about The Get Down and Raising Victor Vargas
yep.
on my month list. And yeah, I look forward to having you on again soon.
Look forward to coming back.
Amores from America is an indie coming-of-age dramedy about experiencing the awkward and sometimes humiliating pangs of adolescence in a strange and new environment. Charming newcomer Marquise Christmas is the titular character who moves to Heidelberg, Germany with his single dad, Curtis, who's played by comedy vet Craig Robinson, after Curtis gets a new job. The transition isn't easy for Morris. He's a shy Black kid suddenly dropped into an all-white world, and the film explores his uneasy friendship with his crush, a slightly older girl named Katrin, as well as his evolving relationship with his father. I recently chatted with Robinson about how his role here shows off a different, more sensitive side, his dark turn as Ray in the TV drama Mr. Robot, and, interestingly enough, the classic sitcom Different Strokes. Hey, Craig, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So in this movie, you play a widowed dad who moves to Germany with his son in order to coach soccer. Can you tell me a little bit about how you became involved with the film and what drew you to the project?
Yes. My agent sent me the script, and you know, he was really excited about it. And Chad Hardigan, who was the director, we had the same agency. So we were hooked up that way, and I really liked the script. I liked the way that my character talked. I liked his relationship with his son, the way they kind of, you know, there was a underlying respect no matter what situation they got in.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought that was interesting to see him portray, especially as, you know, two Black people in Germany.
Yeah, I mean, that's one thing that I feel like there are a lot of elements of the film that, you know, can be considered very, very familiar. It's sort of a coming of age story, and we've seen that before. But what I think makes this film different is the fact that we don't often see sort of the Black American experience in at least indie movies or Hollywood movies, the Black American experience in a foreign country. And so I find that really, that sort of dynamic really fascinating. And then you guys really, the dynamic you two have, you and Marquise Christmas, like, is just really, really great. I love that dynamic that you two share.
Right. And just being in Germany, you know, it lent itself to that isolation.
Mm-hmm.
That even though, you know, there are people around, we still were both very isolated.
Was that your first time in Germany, or had you spent time there before?
That was my first time. I've been to Europe before, but I never been to Germany before. We shot in Heidelberg and in Berlin.
And what was, what do you think of Germany? Like, what was that experience like for you?
I had a wonderful time. It was, Heidelberg is nice and in this quaint, sweet place. There was a festival going on right across the street all the time where I was staying. And there was a castle right next door to that festival. It was awesome. Like, it was a 1,200-year-old castle, a Heidelberg castle. Mm-hmm. It was kind of a rip because they didn't let you go around the whole castle, so I couldn't see, like, where people got tortured and them. But other than that, you know, it was really nice. And then the next week, went to Berlin, and that was just sexy. Berlin is sexy.
Nice. Well, I've never been to Berlin, but I do know that there's probably a more sizable population of people of color in Berlin than there are in Heidelberg. I think in, at one point in the movie, you mentioned that you and Morris are the only two brothers in Heidelberg. Was that true for you while you were there? Like, did you see any other black people there?
I don't recall. No, actually, yeah, I did. There was some servicemen and women there.
Okay.
But I don't remember any black Germans. Mm. Of course, I was just going from, you know, my hotel room pretty much to set, and then I did have a little time when I went to the castle and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Now, so this is, I think, a big departure from a lot of your other roles. It is a comedic role to some extent. There are flashes of comedy, and there are moments of levity, especially between you and Marquise Christmas, who plays your son Morris. But I think that this might be the first time I feel that we've seen you as a single dad, the first time we've seen you sort of take on this more dramatic role. And that's nothing new. We've seen tons of people who are known for being comedians, Steve Martin, Eddie Murphy, Robin Williams. They've taken these roles before. But for you, sort of what made you, you know, aside from the script itself, was this like just the right time for you to take on this role? And at this point in your career, was this the first kind of role that had ever come your way?
It was pretty organic the way it happened. And it's not the first role I had like that. Like early on, like my first and second movie, I was in a movie called Played, and then I was in a short, but I wasn't focused on dramatic pieces. And yeah, I will say this was a great, amazing time to come. Because of this role, I was offered the role of Mr. Robot that I'm on the season, and who knows what else. But I am enjoying this ride. You know, give you a chance to sink your teeth into something and go deeper.
Mm-hmm. And what was that like for you in terms of just, especially that scene towards the end between you and Morris when you're kind of bonding over your mutual doing crazy things for a girl or for women. And that scene is just very, yeah, there's some funny moments there, but it is very, also there's a lot of heft going on there in drama. Like, what was that back and forth going like for you? And also just acting alongside a 13-year-old kid, like, what was that challenge like?
Marquise had a great handle on it. Yeah, you know, this is the first movie and all of that. You know, the chemistry we had, it was effortless. We just worked together well because we clicked right away when we met. And as far as that back and forth, he was pushing me. There was a part where he's crying, you know, and it just took us to that level where we needed to be for that scene.
Mm-hmm. And did you guys bond at all over being two black guys? Or you've obviously been a black child at one point, and just sort of, was there any sort of advice you gave him, sort of joking off set that happened between the two of you?
No. Matter of fact, no. Because we had different hours to shoot, and we, you know, he has his labor laws and all that, I guess. But it was, we would shoot, and then I would usually, since I was only there for a couple of weeks, I would usually be done much later, you know, after he had gotten off, so I could do my other stuff. So we didn't hang out per se. Mm-hmm. I mean, the group, the group did hang out, and we were kicking and stuff. But it wasn't like, hey, come on, let's go around the city, Marquise. Let me tell you about me being a black kid. That did not happen.
Mm-hmm. And I'd also just like to talk a little bit about sort of this concept you mentioned earlier. You know, part of the reason why you're attracted to the film is the fact that it's a story that bond between a black father and a black son. And I'm curious, just the idea of black male vulnerability that I think we see on display in this film. You're playing a dad who's, you know, you're trying to do your best, but it's also difficult because you've moved your son all the way across the country or all the way across the world, and you can only help him so much. And just via, I think, especially the moments via hip hop that happen, there are moments where you guys share rhymes, and there's a scene in which you tell him, you know, rap what you know, don't rap about fucking two bitches, blah, blah, blah. What were you trying to get at in those scenes in terms of what black male vulnerability can be and sort of how that transfers through hip hop and music in particular?
First of all, Chad Harrigan wrote those lyrics, fucking all the bitches two at a time. My thing with this movie is pulling together, being on the same team. Get over the little stuff so you can get to the bigger stuff. And there's a scene in there where Morris curses at Curtis.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's not okay in any stretch. Like if you look at any parent child relationship, it's not okay for, you know, child to be cursing at the parent. It's just not cool. But Curtis like squashes that out of, you know, respect. Hey, you chill, I'll chill, because he knows he needs him on his team. And he knows he's not ready. He's 13 years old. He's not ready for anything that that's being thrown at him in Germany, with his the girl he's in love with. And she's kind of teased, but she's the only one who befriends him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's not ready for any of this stuff, but he does need him, you know, to grow. He needs him to be a man, because he's got to handle his business too.
So one thing, and I think it's also pretty relevant today in terms of all the stuff that's going on politically with Black Lives Matter and, you know, police brutality and this conversation around that. And I think one of the things that we often talk about is the fact that Black kids don't often get to be just kids. And in Morris from America, he's constantly being put in these sort of adult situations, or he's putting himself into these adult situations because he's very curious. And that's sort of part of what being, you know, a 13-year-old kid is. But when he does try to, you know, be a kid and be a Black kid, that moment in one scene where he's rapping in front of all the people in the youth center. He's then, you know, and then at one point, I think one of the head of the youth center says that someone found marijuana and he's automatically under suspicion. Do you relate at all to that sort of theme of always feeling under suspicion and this idea? Like, do you think that the movie's trying to make a bigger point about Black kids just not being able to be kids?
I certainly have my experiences growing up, you know, being a group of us went to the mall. I think we were like celebrating graduating eighth grade or something. And as soon as we walked in the mall, security guard goes, "Well, I don't want no trouble from any of y'all." Like, he just, you know, just as soon as you walked in, it was just, "What are you talking about?"
Mm-hmm.
"Oh, I've been following around, you know, a store," you know, that kind of stuff, as a young man, maybe even older man. So, yeah, I've had those experiences. But I think Chad captured, yeah, and that's why I said, well, we didn't want to push it too far. What I do like is that there are parts in the movie where it does show he does know better. For instance, when the girls want him to take the ecstasy, and he wanted to do it to impress them, but he had done his research on it, and he realized it wasn't for him, so he spit it out. I thought that was a pretty powerful moment, just showing that something is getting through to this kid.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
it's interesting just to talk a little bit about the girl in the movie. Her character's name is Catherine, and she, like you said, she is very much a tease, but she is also like his only lifeline really out there, aside from his dad and his German tutor. And I mean no disrespect to the actress herself, but I kind of felt like the way she was written and the way she's portrayed in the film, she comes off as a sort of Becky type to me, just sort of the absolute worst kind of white girl or white woman who you can like try to befriend. She just causes problems for everyone. I don't know if you see her as that or if I'm off base, but I kind of got the Becky vibe from her.
I mean, I think she genuinely likes him, and she's genuinely, curious about him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because she does spend time with him. You know, she does get to know him, and at the same time, she is, you know, she loves another dude, and you know what I mean. I totally get what you're saying, but I think there was a something genuine about like her wanting to spend time with him and hang out, and like she sees him clocking her, and so she, you know, she hides, and then like, hey, here I am.
Mm-hmm.
I dug it.
Yeah, and also like in a way, she does towards the end sort of in this twisted way give him the confidence to actually rap in front of other people, which, you know, he wasn't able to do at the beginning. He was only able to show that confidence in his bedroom, in the comfort of his bedroom. So
yeah, she pushed him to that level.
And Chad Hartigan, he like you mentioned earlier, he wrote and directed the film, and I'm just curious as to whether, you know, when you before you read the script, if you were at all hesitant about the fact, like I think that he does capture sort of what it's like to be a black person and in an entirely white environment at a young age, like really well. And I was like genuinely surprised at how well it was. And I'm just curious as to whether you were wary at all, or if you thought, you know, why is this white guy writing this very, very personal story? From that point of view?
No, I actually thought Chad was black when I read the script.
Oh.
And then when I met him, I was like, you wrote this?
Mm-hmm.
So no, I like I said, when I first read it, you know, I was like, wow, this is the way I talk, you know? So it was, I was very comfortable. And then when we met, it was like, man, this dude knows what he's talking about.
And you mentioned that you start, like, after you were in this role for Morris from America, that's actually how you got cast by Sam Esmail and in Mr. Robot. And at the time of this recording, we're about more than halfway through season two of Mr. Robot at this point. And I think even more so than Morris from America, this role as Ray in Mr. Robot is an even bigger departure from what we usually see from you. There's pretty much no... There's a little bit of humor in there, but really the last few episodes especially have been super dark. Do you know, so the role, was that written with you in mind, or were there other people considered for the role?
It was not written with me in mind, to my knowledge. It was, I think other people were considered for sure. When we talked about Sam and I, he was telling me about, you know, auditions and stuff, and he was really concerned about this, a certain turn that had to be made. And he wanted the guy to be, you know, jovial and kind of like, you know, the cool dude in the neighborhood. And he also didn't tell me everything about the role.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's another thing I wanted to ask you, is like, how much of the character did you know about when you signed on? Or even now, how much of the, I'm assuming you filmed all of your scenes at this point, but did you know?
Yeah, now I know a lot more.
Okay.
He was like the oracle or something. He just told me what I needed to hear.
Yeah, it's super, just especially, I think it was either last week's episode or the week before, and I'm just going to spoil it because by the time it comes up, you know, whatever. You know, we find out that you are sort of this procurer of the deep web, or like all these very dark things on the internet. And it's just very weird to see you in that sort of light. I think a lot of your characters, honestly, like even your comedic roles, they have sort of an edge to them and a darkness, and just the way I see it is that you're sort of teasing it out in a more darker twisted way. What are some of the craziest fan theories that you've heard about who your character is and how he fits into Elliot's narrative? Because I know at one point we were all speculating as to whether or not he was in a mental institution and you were his handler of some sort or his therapist. And who knows, that could still be the twist. But, like, is there any crazy fan theories that you've heard?
No, that's the one I heard. And I haven't seen a lot about it, and I certainly don't say a lot about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I won't press you for more information, but I'm looking forward to seeing more of what happens exactly. So another thing I wanted to ask you about is that, especially in More From America, and also almost all of your roles, music plays a big part of your roles and what you've done throughout your career. And I believe you have your own band, correct?
Yes.
Okay. What is the band called?
The Nasty Delicious.
Mm. Is it a funk band or R&B? What kind of music?
We're funk mixed with stank. Mm. We play whatever the moment's called for. Originally, the band is an extension of my comedy, because I always play the keyboard with the comedy, right? So, but now with the band, you like, let's say if I'm doing I Will Survive, now you got a drum solo. Now it's a concert.
Mm-hmm.
Because I have these accomplished musicians. So, we're working on some, getting an album out there, get some original tunes and really take it to that next level.
Mm-hmm. And, if you hadn't become a comedian, do you think you would have done? I know you're a music teacher previously, and you sort of drew on that in the last year's TV show, Mr. Robinson. But would you... would you have turned to music full time had you not been a comedian?
When I was in college, I bought a keyboard because I was like, I'm going to be a musician. I'm going to be a singer, and this is what I'm going to do. And then comedy swooped in and took over. I was ready to be like Usher or somebody.
My second to last question would be, is there anyone... You've worked with Chad Hartigan and you've worked with Sam Esmail. Is there anyone in particular who you're like very interested in working with, who's a director in, maybe more of these types of roles? I know Mr. Robot has kind of helped you sort of discover this darker side on the performing end. So is there anyone you'd want to work with in the future?
Yes. Comedically, I would love to work with Ben Stiller. To direct.
Have you not worked with him already?
I've worked with him, but not directing.
Okay, got it.
Directing. Like his comedy mind is like incredible.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't hear a lot about that. Dramatically, Ava DuVernay is someone that I think could bring, challenge me and take me to some places. She's on my dream list to work with.
Yeah, she has a way of bringing out amazing performances. So my last question would be, when was the last time you felt represented on screen?
Represented on screen.
Or if you can't think of the last time, if you can think of the first time you felt represented on screen.
First time I felt represented on screen was Different Strokes.
Interesting.
Willis and Arnold. I have a little brother, so
okay.
So I could be the Willis or Arnold, but I mean, that was, you couldn't touch Gary Coleman back in the day. I had a part in my hair because of Gary Coleman. So yeah, that was the first time I think I was like, felt represented. And I didn't know what I was feeling. I was like, oh man, but I look forward to seeing this kid every week.
Nice. Rest in peace, Gary.
Rest in peace.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today, Craig. It was a pleasure to have you. And everyone, look out for More From America.
Thank you for taking the time and getting the word out.
That's all for today. Thanks again to Tiffany for coming on the show and talking with me about The Get Down. And thank you again to Craig for chatting with me. And you can look out for More From America right now in select theaters and on demand. You'll find a link to some of the many things we discussed today in the show notes. And please, 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 if you liked this conversation and want to hear more, rate us on iTunes. We'd love to hear from you. Represent is produced by the lovely, amazing Verilyn Williams. The executive producer of Slate Podcasts is Steve Lichtig. Andy Bowers is Chief Content Officer of Panoply. And you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Slate Represent. Music is performed by the lovely San Francisco funk soul band Midtown Social. Until next time.